Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore on WKAR 90.5 FM. We have a quick update to a story that we want to share with you. This is a story we aired last Friday. You may remember our Kevin Lavery talking with Brian Parker. Brian is the co-founder of Moo Cluck Moo. Moo Cluck Moo, a fast food restaurant in Dearborn Heights specializing in burgers and chicken. Get it? Very cute. The story was about Parker's shop starting his workers off at $12 an hour. $12 an hour starting pay at a fast food operation in suburban Detroit. Just before Labor Day, there had been protests and strikes across the country from fast food employees seeking $15 per hour. The latest development is that Moo Cluck Moo in Dearborn Heights will pay its food service workers $15 per hour starting October 1st. In a written press release, Brian Parker says he thinks back to the days when auto pioneer Henry Ford paid his employees five whole dollars a day. Parker says, quote, "It worked then, it will work now." Very interesting development, and it sounds like a good place to work. We have some interesting Great Lakes-related content coming up here later this hour. I hope you can stick around for that. At the top of our show, our first guest has twice before served as a Michigan State University trustee. Last week, former business owner Melanie Foster of East Lansing announced she wants to serve again. Two positions on the MSU board will be determined in just over a year. She is running as half of a two-person team. Her partner is fellow Republican Jeff Sakwa. And to discuss why she wants to become an MSU trustee again and to share her views on the William Penn situation and others, we welcome Melanie Foster to Current State. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure, our pleasure. Talk to us why you want to rejoin the MSU board. This would be your third stint, correct?
Well, my first stint was a two-year appointment. And then I ran in 2000, which was back in the early 90s, 91, 92. I was appointed by Governor Engler. Then in 2004, I ran for the board and won and served out that eight-year term.
Okay. And you served on the CMU board in between those two.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. I served 7 years on Central Michigan University's board. I was chair of the board. I had the opportunity to co-chair a national presidential search there for Mike Rao, who is now the president at Virginia Commonwealth University. Mm-hmm. And so it was a tremendous experience with the Chippewas.
Why do you want to get back on the MSU board?
Well, it's easy to say you love Michigan State and you're passionate about it, as so many thousands of us are, but there's a lot of work to be done. I'll tell you a couple of things I care about deeply. One is keeping Michigan State University accessible and affordable for the citizens of the state of Michigan. There's been a trend the past few years to admit more out-of-state and foreign undergraduate students, and that trend to me is very troubling. I mean, I understand that we have to have a robust, diverse campus, but there's a lot of diversity right here within the state of Michigan. And as we continue to admit more out-of-state and foreign students, we are displacing qualified Michigan residents. And that troubles me because it's our tax dollars that support Michigan State University.
Mm-hmm. Has the William Penn episode by any chance made you any more eager to get involved again, or
absolutely
has it reminded you how challenging the business can be that comes before the board?
Absolutely, it's very troubling what happened here at the beginning of the semester. First day in class for most of the students in that class were sophomores, maybe some freshmen, and the Penn issue. I want to advocate is not about academic freedom in the classroom or politics, but it's about academic integrity and quality teaching in the classroom. And this has really brought to light that professors should be accountable for teaching the content of the class that the student registered to take.
Yesterday on this program, Professor May Kirkendall, the president of the MSU chapter of the American Association of University Presidents, claimed due process was violated, that the situation required a more careful, more deliberate process. Let's listen to a bit of her position.
the faculty, in you know, looking at what he does, has consistently thought that there is value in it and that he's controversial, but that controversy is not something we should fear. I do want to make sure you understand that due process within the American Academy is always supposed to depend upon faculty input. Let me read this to you. At well-run colleges and universities, faculty exercise significant influence over areas including research, the curriculum, and faculty status, such as hiring, promotion, and discipline. Boards and administrators rely on faculty advice in making academic decisions. So in this case, so far as we're aware, there's been no faculty input.
So Professor Kuykendall doubts whether there was sufficient faculty input before the university yanked Professor Penn from the classroom. Any particular response to that opinion? Is there credibility to that argument as far as you're concerned?
Look, I applaud the president, senior administration, and the Board of Trustees for acting in a very expeditious matter on this. I mean, they were quick. They dealt with the issue at hand, and they dealt with it promptly. I mean, they had a rogue professor ranting his liberal political views to the class, insulting people in the class, bullying, intimidating students. This is not a learning environment. Again, don't politicize this. This is about students paying thousands of dollars. In fact, the young man who taped the class, his tuition for that class alone is $4,500 roughly, and not getting the value of what they paid for. I mean, this class was about identity as it's formed by literature and comedy. It had nothing to do with this rant that went on. And at the university, let me highlight this. This comes from President Simon, and I'm going to quote, okay? "While we may disagree with one another's positions, as a learning community, we must respect the rights of individuals to express their positions without fear of intimidation." That was not the environment in that classroom.
Professor Kuykendall yesterday, and I know an awful lot of other faculty, would also maintain that one of their biggest responsibilities is to provoke young minds, and that it, and sometimes, as May Kuykendall said yesterday on the show, I think she said, some of these gambits work, some of these gambits fail. Could I get your response to that? There is a dimension of intellectual provocation that takes place in the classroom, and I think we all accept that.
Right. That's part of the learning community of a world-class university, which okay. Michigan State is, and I concur with that. But this was not that type of environment. Look at Kuffer's. I mean, there's a one-star rating. I mean, the if you go back and look through the quotes from students for years going backwards on the content of this class, it's really pretty appalling.
This is Kuffer's.com is a website on which students share their experiences and opinions of particular professors.
And classes.
Correct.
And classes.
And classes.
Specific classes, yes.
Another MSU prof, Bonnie Buckaroo of the School of Journalism, suggested, I'm going to revisit the politics dimension to this here. I feel obligated to. Professor Buckaroo suggested in a piece in Lansing Online News that Professor Penn's removal was because of the U's having to curry favor with a Republican majority in state government.
This has nothing to do about politics. It's about bullying in the classroom. The classroom, as I stated, is for an open exchange of ideas and knowledge, and it's not a place for offensive rhetoric and political propaganda.
Yes, yes.
I mean, fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was insulting. This was the first day of class. Where was the syllabus? Isn't that what first day of classes is talking about, the syllabus? I mean, it's about accountability. We're a world-class institution. We have thousands of fabulous professors every day in the classroom that are delivering great content to the students. I mean, why wouldn't if Michigan State wasn't a great brand, we wouldn't have 32,000 applicants as we did last year to come here. Yes. Michigan State's a great brand.
Yesterday, I portrayed this. I suggested that this really highlighted the tension between two central features of university life: academic freedom and freedom of speech on one hand, and a tradition of respect and civility on the other, pretty much colliding. Is it fair to look at it that way?
Well, it's a responsibility, I feel, in the classroom to create open exchange for dialogue. I mean, but this wasn't the environment there. It was bullying and intimidation.
Having served on the board before, Melanie, can you give us any insight into how much communicating is going on right now amongst the trustees?
I'm certain to say there was a lot last week. I mean, when your university ends up on national television, it certainly is a topic of the board, and not in a good light. I mean, obviously, it was not in a good light, which is unfortunate.
College affordability and student debt is a relevant topic, ongoing relevant topic. A month or so ago, the Obama administration proposed a student loan repayment plan. This is an expansion of a pay-as-you-go type plan that would forgive unpaid student loan debt after the students in the working world for a decade, for 10 years. It would forgive any unpaid student debt. Any particular response to that idea from the Obama administration?
I really feel I need to study that more than I'm not prepared to respond to that yet. But it gets down to people are paying a lot of money to go to college, and they need value. They need value that they can take out professionally to the workplace once they graduate. And it's a responsibility of this institution to teach content that has value.
Can a credible case be made that too many young people are in college?
I don't know that too many are in college, but are they going to college and learning the right stuff that has value going forward?
Do you support Terry Lynn Land for U.S. Senate?
I think Terry Lynn is a great candidate. I mean, she outpolled Jennifer Granholm when she ran for Secretary of State, and Granholm ran for governor. Terry Lynn was a higher vote getter, so she's a dynamo.
If Congressman Card, Congressman Rogers hadn't dropped out, would you be more behind their candidacy?
No, that's
than you
a what
are?
If. That didn't happen. So, you know, Terry Lynn's a great candidate, and I'm very happy to see that she's running.
We want to thank Melanie Foster of East Lansing for joining us to open up Current State here today. Melanie's a candidate for the MSU Board of Trustees. It would be her third stint on the board. Melanie, thanks and good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, water attracted early settlers to Detroit, and water fueled its growth. Now it's an important asset to the city's recovery. Today, Current State continues to explore Detroit's waterfront challenges and opportunities in our series, Detroit's Water Renaissance. So far, we've looked at daylighting streams and rebuilding shorelines. Today, we explore the Detroit River's fishing industry. Detroit's known for a lot of things, but one of the most surprising is walleye fishing. Starting in the early spring, intrepid sportsmen descend on the Detroit River in pursuit of trophy-size walleye that are there to spawn. Current State contributor Judy Smelser takes us fishing on the river with expert guide Lance Valentine.
You ready?
Yep.
If you build a perfect walleye habitat, I think you'd have a hard time beating the Detroit River.
Lance should know. He's been an expert walleye angler for more than 15 years.
And what I want you to do is when you lift the rod, is let line out, then grab the line at the top.
Because it's a major spawning ground for Lake Erie, because it is so diverse in the locations that fish can live, because there's so much bait, because the water is so clean and constantly flowing, it just creates a perfect habitat, not just for walleyes, for every game fish.
It's a very distinct thump when it hits the bottom.
The Detroit River, Lake St. Clair, and the St. Clair River are known as the connecting waters because they link Lake Erie to Lake Huron. They're also part of the Lake Erie sport fishery, known as one of the best places in the world to catch walleye. It's the largest fishery in the Great Lakes and supports a $1 billion sport fishing industry. Michigan's portion of this rather large pie translates to millions of dollars.
It's amazing what this river has done for my business and my family.
Lance Valentine has a much more personal view of this lucrative situation. His business, Walleye 101, is designed around the needs of walleye anglers. It includes educational charters, seminars, DVDs, and a walleye pro shop that sells specialized tackle.
Look at that!
Ah!
Oh, yay!
You're officially a junior.
I think so.
The walleye fishing in the Detroit River was really the genesis of how everything has kind of exploded for us, because people want to learn how to fish it, and we were able to help them. So the Detroit River is a pretty special place for me. It's a large part of my income because of all the things we do.
Similar stories can be found throughout the area because walleye anglers need everything from gas and bait to food and lodging. Mike Bobion is the owner of Libra Marina, a 100-slip marina in Wyandotte, just southwest of Detroit. He can point directly to walleye fishing season for the uptick in his business over the last 10 years.
It's increased our season, and when it starts, our normal season really doesn't even begin till like June and runs till October, so it's extended my season by 2 months.
But things weren't always this robust. In the early 70s, fishing in the Detroit River nearly ground to a halt due to the extreme amount of pollutants being dumped in the water. Cleanup efforts began toward the end of the decade, and by the late 80s, walleye fishing rebounded. Recently, concern has been expressed about the declining population of walleye in the lake. According to the Lake Erie Committee's 2013 annual report, the estimate of the total number of walleye in Lake Erie has declined by about 7 million in the last year. Some fingers have been pointed at the anglers, but it turns out they're not the problem. For other species of fish, say salmon for example, the amount of spawning females has a direct relationship to the amount of young produced. According to Mike Thomas, a fisheries biologist from the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, those factors don't apply to walleye.
The driving factors are environmental conditions, and when you have just the right conditions, even a relatively low number of adults are going to produce enough eggs that you can have a really successful year class produced.
So if the harvesting of spawning fish is not an issue for walleye populations, what is causing this downward trend in abundance? Mike Thomas explains.
The situation in Lake Western Basin and Lake Erie is that we see big harmful algae blooms coming back over the last 5 to 10 years, resembling some of the algae blooms that were seen back in the 70s. There's some suspicion that it could be contributing to a trend of what would look to be lower levels of spawning success for walleyes in the Western Basin of Lake Erie.
John Hartick has seen this situation firsthand. He is the refuge manager for the Detroit River International Wildlife Refuge, which encompasses 48 miles of shoreline, including the lower Detroit River and the western shoreline of Lake Erie.
Algal blooms have come back and come back with a vengeance. And so here we've spent billions and billions of dollars on controlling phosphorus from municipalities and industries, and what's going on? And it's the runoff off the land that's a big source of the phosphorus now.
The algae blooms seen in the 60s and 70s were a result of point source pollution. This means you could identify a specific source, like a water treatment plant, for the pollutant. The algae blooms we see now are a result of non-point source pollution. This means pollution comes from many diffuse sources, like agricultural runoff. Now, algae blooms are only one part of this ecological threat to walleye. The other is invasive species. Again, Mike Thomas.
The zebra mussels and quagga mussels are also thought to, in Lake Erie's case, to be contributing to some extent to these harmful algae blooms as well.
John Hartig characterizes these threats in a more system-wide manner.
Something is awry in one component of the ecosystem, it's going to show up in others.
Identifying the problem is one thing, but solving it is another. John Hartig says the effort to address these concerns is well underway.
Because we have people working these issues, you know, I'm optimistic that we can sustain a high-quality fishery over time, but we can't lose our sense of urgency.
It seems this sense of urgency is shared by parts of the angling community. Lance Valentine, owner of Walleye 101, believes that education and engagement are the key.
So the more people we can get to fall in love with this river, I think the better it is for everybody involved, from the fishermen to the business people to the river itself. It's the loudest voice sometimes that wins, so we need to be united as anglers. If you care about this fishery, you need to do something to be part of it.
There we go.
That's a small walleye.
For Current State and Great Lakes Echo, I'm Judy Smelser.
This story was produced by WKAR's Current State and Great Lakes Echo with support from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. We continue our series next Tuesday by looking at the impact of Detroit's industrial past on the Rouge River. In the meantime, organizations from across the Great Lakes region are converging in Milwaukee for Great Lakes Week. Great Lakes journalist and commentator Gary Wilson is at this year's conference. Wilson's a member of the Society of Environmental Journalists and currently writes for Great Lakes Echo. Gary, welcome back to Current State.
Hey, Mark. Good morning. It's always good to be with the people from mid-Michigan.
It's great to have you back. What's the atmosphere like at this conference? Is everyone playing nice with one another?
Well, for the most part, they are, Mark. For the most part, there was a little bit of tension yesterday when the subject of water diversions came up, diverting water from Lake Michigan to the town of Waukesha. We've talked about that a little bit in the past, and that always gets people's hackles up a little bit. But for the most part, there's a collaborative spirit here.
Remind us why Waukesha needs Great Lakes water from their point of view. Why is that the case, and why is divergence so controversial?
Yeah, the Waukesha needs water. Whether they need Great Lakes water is the question to be resolved. They're under that EPA mandate to find a new water source because their wells are contaminated with radium. And this has been playing out over a number of years, actually almost 10 years. But they're right at the cusp. Waukesha has determined that the Great Lakes and Lake Michigan are the best source of water, but they're outside of the Great Lakes Basin, just by a few miles. But if you're out, you're out. So they have to make an application for Great Lakes water, justify the need so they can divert water, about 10 million gallons a day. And that has to be approved by all of the Great Lakes states. If one governor in a Great Lakes state says no, then they can't have the water. So the bar is pretty high, and the stakes are pretty high for not only for Waukesha, but for the region, because this will be a precedent-setting request. So if this gets a tough review, then people that come after Waukesha, they can expect a tough review in that Great Lakes compact that's meant to keep the water in the basin. Will have teeth. If it's not a tough review, then the compact could be at risk. So a lot of discussion about that in Milwaukee. It's top of mind.
What were there particular opinions aired yesterday that you can share with us?
Yeah, it boils down to the real question here is how much water Waukesha needs. Waukesha is asking, like I said, for 10 million gallons a day. They've made a case for that. And they provide a lot of supporting material. But others and the people with strong opinions and in positions of a lot of responsibility, they say that Waukesha's need really isn't that much, that they're using Great Lakes water to support economic growth and suburban sprawl, and that doesn't fit with the intent of the Great Lake Compact. And it doesn't take very long for voices to be raised, professionally so, but voices to be raised. The gentleman, Dan Dukniak, who runs the Waukesha Water Facility, he made a presentation yesterday to the Great Lakes Commission, which is really the governor's representatives from around the region, and he did a good job of making his case, but when it was time for Q&A, hard questions started coming. So, and that's only going to intensify in the next months.
One other pretty important topic is this recommendation that governments build structures in strategic points around the Great Lakes to, I take it this is to slow down the amount of water getting out of the Great Lakes. Do I have that? Do I have that correct?
Yeah, pretty much, Mark. The structures would be in mostly in the St. Clair River to potentially reduce the outflow from Lake Huron. If you're up in the Georgian Bay in Lake Huron, those folks up there are very concerned. The lake levels are low, and they're losing shoreline, you know, quickly, and beachfront. And this has been playing out for quite some time. There is a lot of discussion about that here. There is no silver bullet.
Is there any kind of emerging consensus from your point of view, Gary?
No, there's not. The camps are the governments of the U.S. and Canada need to do something, and these man-made structures would be you know, a potential solution, although they're controversial in themselves. And then there's the other side of it is, hey, the lakes go up and the lakes go down, and there's not a whole lot that man could or should be doing about it. And I don't see, I see no consensus on that, Mark. It's going to play out over a long period of time.
Lana Pollock, who is a figure that a lot of our listeners know about, formerly of Ann Arbor, is U.S. chair for the commission. She refused to sign plans to build these structures because of the plans, and I'll quote, insufficient emphasis on climate change and the need for governments to pursue adaptive management strategies in the basin. I take it she represents one of the sides that resists the structures. What does she call? What is it that she's calling for when she says insufficient emphasis on climate change?
There is a consensus on the cause of the low lake levels, the primary cause, and that's the evaporation of the diminished ice cover, which has led to evaporation of so much of the lakes. Her view is that we can talk about man-made structures. They're going to be expensive. We don't really know if they're going to work or not, but that's putting the emphasis in the wrong place. This is a climate change issue from her perspective, and in the short term, cities and areas around the lakes need to learn how to adapt longer to the lower lake levels because it's only likely to get worse. And longer term, we need to do things, you know, on the greenhouse gas side to reduce emissions. That's the only long-term fix. She didn't believe that her fellow commissioners gave that enough emphasis on in the report that they issued to the two governments. And I had asked her a couple months ago just about that, and she said that she wasn't going to sign it. She said there's a lot of good information in the report, but she wasn't going to sign it just for the sake of a unanimous report.
Well, what additional measures does Lana Pollock support? Is it clear what kinds of measures she does support to address these longer-term climate change concerns?
Well, her and another executive, David Ulrich, who leads the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, which is a group of mayors, they're really kind of beating the bushes here this week to talk about getting people to focus more on climate change. That's really their
but how?
Mantra.
Do they go into detail as to how?
No, they don't. And it's delicate because climate change has got a lot of political baggage that comes with it. And automatically, the discussion kind of gets diverted about climate change, and it's a tough sell sometimes, depending on the venue.
Gary, do you feel the people at this conference are talking about the right issues, or do you think there are other pressing issues that are arguably being neglected?
Asian carp is not big on the agenda this year. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. The Asian carp problem hasn't gone away. It's just as posing just as big a risk as it has in the past, but one of the risks is people have short attention spans. They can focus on and this includes agency people, not-for-profits, the environmental folks. You know, you have a hyper-focus on something for a while, and then people get burned out. That doesn't mean that, you know, good work isn't happening about Asian carp, but it's not top of mind here. And last year in Cleveland, that's all anybody wanted to talk about. So You know, we have a risk of always coming up onto the new next best thing and forgetting about the work that's left undone.
Very interesting. Great Lakes journalist and commentator Gary Wilson there. Gary will be back with us at the end of the month to review some of the top stories from around the Great Lakes Basin. Gary, thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Bye-bye.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan business owners continue efforts to understand their responsibilities ahead of the launch of the Federal Affordable Care Act. A few weeks ago, Current State spoke with Rob Fowler, CEO of the Small Business Association of Michigan, who talked about the challenges business owners are facing. He said many of his members are struggling.
Parts of it apply to companies only over 50. Parts of it apply to all companies. Parts of it apply to companies with health insurance. Some of things apply to those who don't provide health insurance to their employees. Sorting out what it means to me as a company is the real challenge.
To begin part two of our interview, I asked Rob Fowler about frequently reported fears of a hiring slowdown as some businesses worry about future costs associated with the ACA. He said a hiring slowdown is unfolding in two ways.
It's been in the news recently that there's a lot of talk about people might have to have two part-time jobs. And what's driving that is in the ACA, there's a definition of part-time. It's under 30 hours. If your employees are part-time, they're treated differently than if they are full-time.
Right.
You're obligated, over 50 employees, you're obligated to provide health insurance or pay a fine for full-time employees. And I think the natural reaction, again, one that I think the business community tried to warn about, was you put 30 hours in the law, and then 30 hours becomes the new standard. We do see a number of companies, and this isn't all companies. This is going to be a lot of companies that have low margin. They make a little bit off every product and have to sell a whole bunch of them to make any money. Low margin, where their employers are mostly low wage. I think this is where you're going to see this 29-hour work week really become the norm. Again, an unintended consequence, but a consequence pretty seriously of the ACA. The other way I think we see this is truly costs are going up, and that hasn't stopped. And so this combination of requiring employers to provide health insurance and not having given any relief in cost hasn't solved that problem at all. And I think you'll see, even if you pay a low wage, but you have to provide health insurance to an employee, the health insurance can be almost as much as the wage in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it much more expensive to bring every new person on board. And I think you'll see a slowdown as a result of that added cost.
Back in June, NPR's John Itzde did a story with a number of small business owners about the Affordable Care Act and its impact. One part of that report included a small manufacturer from Kansas who sounded more optimistic, in part because he feels the choices offered by insurance marketplaces would push costs down. Let's listen to that small manufacturer. His name is Todd Allison.
I would like to see the exchanges go online, and I would like to see them work. I honestly believe that free market economy and capitalism will drive the cost of health insurance down if you give it a chance.
Now, according to this report, Allison provides health care for his 30 or so employees, and the ACA has not slowed down his hiring. Do you hear any of your members make those kinds of comments?
Well, I think we small business people are optimistic by nature, you know, and I think there is a hope that the exchange itself, you know, people compare it to a Travelocity or something where you can actually look at all the options side by side.
Exactly.
And that transparency will create real competition. And, you know, I think we all hope that will happen. But here's the reality. I mean, if you're an employer today, you have that. It comes in the form of an insurance agent, an independent insurance agent. That's how most small employers buy their health insurance. And the insurance agent has access to all the pricing of all the providers, insurance providers, and basically compares those side by side and brings them and presents them to the employer. I'm even optimistic that, that there may be a beneficial effect of a really public listing of rates. I think mostly that's going to happen in the individual market and will have less beneficial impact in the group market. So because we have this health insurance agent relationship already who bring us comparative side-by-side, there's already that competition because insurers know that, that they're going to be side-by-side with other with their competition in front of a customer. So I think it can be beneficial on the individual side. I'm less optimistic that it's really going to be a driver of cost down in the group market, again, because I think that, that element of competition is already there.
We're talking with Rob Fowler, CEO of the Small Business Association of Michigan, about the impact of the Affordable Care Act on his members. I'd like to ask you about the healthcare exchanges that are scheduled to open October 1st. The federal government will be fully in charge of the exchanges in 19 states, and Michigan is one of those states. How is that impacting your members?
You know, it's interesting. So I said earlier that I think, you know, while we didn't support the Affordable Care Act, if it's going to be the law of the land, we think it ought to be done correctly as it's implemented in Michigan. Our policymakers actually missed the opportunity to have a state-based, state-controlled exchange.
How did your members feel about that?
Well, we supported it being in our own control from a Michigan perspective. So having not done that, and I think the opponents of it calculated that if you just don't cooperate with the Affordable Care Act, that it then you're not complicit. you're not helping it. But I'm not sure that helped us, us as Michiganders and us as small businesses in our state. We think it probably would have been better to have a state-managed, state-controlled. That ship has sailed. I think the differences to the public and maybe to our members will not be vast, will not be obvious. You're still going to have the same sort of ability to go and compare plans. Honestly, the relationship with insurance companies, state rating laws, and other things are the places where we might have been better off had we had it been a state exchange. Not a huge difference, I think, to the consumer at the end of the day.
I'm curious about the percentages here with regard to your membership. You've said that SBAM is in support of Medicaid expansion on one hand, but is formally on the record as being against the Affordable Care Act. How much diversity of opinion is there among your members on those issues?
We've been hearing from our members quite a bit on this, and I think it seems inconsistent to be opposed to the Affordable Care Act but in favor of Medicaid expansion.
They are designed to work together, really, and from the federal government's point of view.
I don't think we'd be having this conversation about Medicaid expansion were it not for the Affordable Care Act. So our, you know, this isn't a philosophical difference. We don't support the great expansions of government. We're not really in favor of the government being deeply involved in our day-to-day health care. But Medicaid, you know, we can have a whole discussion about Medicaid and its efficacy and effectiveness. But so long as the rules are that the poor in this country are covered by Medicaid, then Medicaid needs to cover the poor, all of them. Because for those that are not covered by Medicaid today, whether we like it or not, those costs are shifted along to the paying customers. We've known that for a long time, long before the Affordable Care Act came along. So we believe this is sort of an opportunity to give relief to people who pay insurance premiums. We've understood that the uninsured are not just a societal problem, but it's our problem as the business community. We really have got to understand that those costs are shifted to us. It's a big driver, and that we have to be part of the solution. So from our perspective, while, again, we didn't support the Affordable Care Act, we really have to take advantage of this opportunity to give some relief to our small business members as it relates to those shifted costs.
Rob Fowler is the CEO of the Small Business Association of Michigan. We'll be right back. For the United States, the War of 1812 took a turn for the better on this date 200 years ago. American naval forces defeated the British in the Battle of Lake Erie. The victory secured the lake and ensured that Michigan and Ohio would remain the sovereign territory of the USA. Current State Scott Pohl talked with MSU historian Roger Rosentrater about the Battle of Lake Erie.
There are no roads to speak of in this part of the country at the time, and the lakes are the most efficient means of moving men and materiel. And the British have got about a dozen boats on Lake Erie in Ontario. The United States has one, and we lose that one with the surrender of Detroit. So what the government decides to do is say, all right, we've got to figure out a way to challenge the British on Lakes Ontario and Erie. And they began a boat-building effort. So that's how we get to what becomes the Battle of Lake Erie a year later. By the spring of 1813, a year into the war, a 27-year-old veteran of the U.S. Navy, a guy with a great military name, Oliver Hazard Perry, is at Erie, Pennsylvania, and he's orchestrating the building of a small fleet, particularly two brigs. Now, I'm not a Navy guy, but a brig is a two-masted, fast-moving ship with about 20 guns. So by the late summer of 1813, he is now moving to western Lake Erie. He is going to be challenged by a British naval force out of Fort Malden, which is in Amherstburg, which is just downriver from Detroit. Captain Barclay is the guy's name. Now, he is a veteran of the Battle of Trafalgar of 1805. So this guy is a capable naval officer, but he has a smaller fleet, and he's really got a shortage of sailors. So as a result, what happens by early September of 1813, Barclay decides, I've got to challenge the American fleet because I've got to open up that supply route to the east. I've got a lot of troops and Indians and dependents at Amherstburg who need food. And that's being stopped by the fact that there's now an American fleet on Lake Erie.
Oliver Hazard Perry gives us a couple of the great rallying points of the war. And I'd like to talk about both of them, if I could. Okay. The first is, don't give up the ship, which lives in infamy. Can you tell me how he employed that phrase?
Well, that actually belonged to a man he admired who he'd served under, who was a Captain Lawrence, who is killed earlier in the War of 1812. So that is the don't give up the ship again, don't surrender, all part of that Navy legacy that gets established earlier in the war. The second one that you mentioned, which is real significant, has to do with the Battle of Lake Erie, which is now September 10th, 1813, when Barclay's six boats confront the American fleet of nine boats, which is then laying at anchor at Put-in Bay, which is just north of Sandusky, Ohio. Now, both sides have two large boats, that simply, right? And Perry's flagship is the Lawrence, named after the man he had admired. And what happens in the fight is that the two larger British boats pound the Lawrence. Matter of fact, after about 2 hours of pounding, the Lawrence is badly battered. It suffered 80% casualties. Curiously enough, one of the people not wounded in this fight is Commodore Perry. He gets in a rowboat and is rowed a half a mile to the Niagara. Now, the Niagara is his other big boat.
While under fire.
I mean, the shells are flying, and there's actually a dramatic painting. Naturally, he's standing up, you know, just like George Washington at the Delaware, right?
In a canoe.
Yes, right. Well, this time he's in a rowboat, but he's standing up. I don't think he was standing up. But nevertheless, Perry makes it to the Niagara. Now, what's important about that is the Niagara has kind of stayed out of the fight, much to Perry's curiosity. I mean, he's wondering, why is that boat out there? Well, I'm taking this pounding. Well, to a certain degree, it works out real well because he gets the Niagara. And at that point, the British, who have suffered as well, matter of fact, a lot of the British officers are down at that point, figure, look, we pretty much won. Okay, we were outnumbered, but we've won. The Americans are going to retreat. Well, Perry doesn't retreat. Instead, he heads back into the fight. The winds freshen in his favor. Again, these are all sail ships. And in a matter of 15 minutes, what happens is the two larger British boats collide. Their masts get entangled. The Americans come in, again, with the wind in their favor, and they blast the British boats, and in a few minutes, literally in a few minutes, it's over.
Hugely impacted by the luck of Mother Nature.
and the Niagara as well, because if the Niagara had been in the fight earlier, who knows what would have happened. So even though Commodore Perry and the captain of the Niagara will have their discussions well after the fight, and they'll fight in the press about why didn't you, et cetera, it benefits the Americans, certainly. What happens then is the British surrender. Both sides suffer about the same number of casualties, about 30, 40 killed and about three times that number of wounded. And very dramatically, as you know, and here's your second quote, Perry, on the back of an envelope, curiously enough, will send a note to the American Army commander, William Henry Harrison, quote, "We have met the enemy and they are ours."
Lots of great American history written on the backs of envelopes.
Well, at least that one. No, and Lincoln didn't write the Gettysburg Address, as we know, on the back of an envelope. But Perry did write on the back of an envelope, though after his day, maybe it's okay. We can give him, we'll cut him some slack on that one. What happens, though, which is why it's real important for Michigan, is the British now evacuate Fort Malden, and they evacuate Detroit. Perry will now able to, despite the fact that his boat, the Lawrence, has taken a pounding, he's got other boats, he can now ferry General Harrison's army across the Detroit River, and they begin to follow the fleeing British army. And on October 5th, at the Battle of the Thames, which is near Chatham, Ontario, the Americans will crush the British force. Matter of fact, the dramatic part of that battle is the Indian leader Tecumseh will be killed.
Is it fair to say this is where the tide has turned?
Definitely. The American war in the West has shifted considerably as a result of the Battle of Lake Erie. Matter of fact, what will happen is that not only will the Americans reoccupy Detroit, which is good for those folks who certainly have suffered for a year of British occupation, but the Americans will continue to control Lake Erie for the balance of the war. So again, the Battle of Lake Erie is small by naval standards, but it is considerably important, not just in the War of 1812, but in American naval history.
What do we know about naval communications between ships in a fight of this sort, where there's long distances, there's the sound of cannons? How are they able to communicate with each other?
There's a lot of smoke, too.
I'm sure there is.
Don't lose sight of that, because that's one of the things that really, on a battlefield or even on the seas, is going to impact things. My sense is you can do it with flags, to a certain degree. I'm not enough of an expert to know how many flags you're able to do, but that's how they're doing it even into the 20th century, I think. You know, if you're trying to maintain a certain amount of radio silence, and obviously there are no radios in 1813, that would be one way to communicate. But there's no doubt that in this particular fight, Perry's out there going, why is the Niagara out of the fight when I could use him and we're taking a beating here?
I don't know if you ever engage in historical speculation, but what would have been the result if we had lost this battle?
Given the way the War of 1812 unfolds, it's a little bit unclear what might have happened. The Americans still had success in Lake Ontario in 1814, which is again tied to the success at the Battle of Lake Erie. So you again would have possibly taken that out of the equation. Without rambling on, we should never have been in the War of 1812 to begin with, and we got out of it. We were very lucky we got out of it as we did. Losing the Battle of Lake Erie, possibly the Americans would have come back a second time, rebuilt another fleet. It was a real challenge to build a fleet. That's something we didn't even discuss. But the whole idea of finding, Erie, Pennsylvania, for example, doesn't have any major shipyards. I mean, even something as simple as nails were a shortage. And getting cannon to places like Erie poses a real challenge as well. So I would imagine losing the Battle of Lake Erie would have been a major setback, clearly. But William Henry Harrison has a large American army. He might very well have attacked Detroit. Possibly that would have, again, the British still have communication and manpower issues. So maybe it would have dragged on, been a whole lot bloodier.
I know in recent days there have been reenactments on the water, and that there is a lot of attention paid to keeping this history alive. That's pretty important to a lot of people. Can you talk about how we have kept the memory of a lot of these events alive?
There's a couple good ways, I think, that we've done it. One of them is there is a USS Niagara out there. It is the third such vessel with the name Niagara, launched in 1988. It's berthed in Erie, Pennsylvania, where they have a maritime museum as well. And the Niagara is a sailing school vessel which travels the Great Lakes. So, I mean, one of those tall ships that visits various ports on the Great Lakes. The other thing is that if you go to Put-in Bay, South Bass Island in particular, the National Park Service operates a Perry Monument. It is 352 feet tall. It has just been recently renovated, is my understanding. So you can go to the top of it and look out, and without sounding too cynical, you can see Lake Erie. And you can kind of see where the battle took place. But they do a good job, as the National Park Service always does, in making an effort to interpret and preserve important events like this one.
MSU historian Roger Rosentrater, thank you for another one of your visits to help us remember Michigan history. Good talking with you.
Thanks, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we speak with young adult author Holly Black, coming to Lansing and Okemos tomorrow. We'll talk about her latest book, The Coldest Girl in Cold Town. Also, MSU musician Etienne Charles on his new album, Creole Soul. All that and more coming up in the show tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.